better.
Thank you all for coming out tonight. This is fantastic.
Romantic Outlaws is a highly detailed, granular, almost daily recounting of the lives and exploits of a group of geniuses in early 19th century England, or from early 19th century England. These people were creative, courageous, brilliant artists and rebels who almost invariably in their personal lives acted like idiots. They were, it's staggering. I think if you put them all together, their emotional IQ would equal that of a 16-year-old girl. It's just, or boy. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, well said, well said. It's so much fun to follow these people and see their brilliance and want to strangle them at the same time. It's a great read, and I recommend it highly. Years ago, Charlotte and I were beginning writers together, and even then it was too late to be young writers. But we were friends, and that was critical, because it's so important for writers to have friends who are also writers, because no one other than another writer can understand the torment, the agony we experience almost hourly that mortals they have no comprehension of. And we learn things from each other too. For example, I learned from Charlotte on the occasion of her first reading from her first book, in the course of which she did not read a single word from that book, but sort of just stood up there and free associated for half an hour. And I thought, man, this is brilliant, because we're writers, and our job is to write this shit, and you guys are supposed to read it. Right? So without further ado, I will introduce my good friend Charlotte Gordon, who I hope will not be reading from her new and wonderful book, Romantic Outlaws.
This is so fun, after having been locked in my room for 10 years. I can't, just pretend you're interested, because I need that feedback. I had heard of Mary Wollstonecraft, who wrote A Vindication of the Rights of Women, and I had heard of Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein, but I had never realized that they were mother and daughter. And when I figured that out, I was so intrigued that I started to read all these biographies, and I decided to start with the mother. So I started with Mary Wollstonecraft. Mary Wollstonecraft is really famous because she wrote A Vindication of the Rights of Women. She lived in the 18th century, and she was wild. I thought, of course she would be the mother of Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein. Of course Mary Shelley would have this cool, pioneering mother. And as I read the pages in my Mary Wollstonecraft biography, I got even more excited. Here she was, pioneering her way through her life. She grew up in a horrible family, yet she persevered. Her father was an alcoholic and beat everybody, and she slept on the threshold of her mother's door to protect her mother from her horrible father. And when the years after that, when her younger sister married an abusive husband, she rescued the sister from the husband, all during a time when it was illegal for women to own property, to have their own money, to get a divorce, when domestic abuse was not only legal but encouraged. The only restriction was that the whip should not be thicker than your thumb. Mary Wollstonecraft was outraged at this injustice and was fighting it from the time she was a little girl. She had a tyrannical older brother that I think she was probably fighting with him from the moment she was born. And she took that spirit with her into her life and was an incredibly courageous woman. She actually began her writing life by writing about the education of young people. She went on to become increasingly concerned about justice and social justice. And in fact, her first big book was not a vindication of the rights of women. It was a vindication of the rights of men. And yes. And she very much anticipated 21st century feminism that says, in fact, the rights of all human beings are going to be improved if the rights of oppressed peoples are improved. And that's where she started from. She then took on the challenge of writing about women. And this was incredibly brave because not only were women not supposed to own property and, you know, initiate divorces, etc., the reason they weren't allowed to do any of this is because all of the experts held that women were, you know, stupid. The most important organ in the female anatomy was the uterus. And really, a woman's job was to keep that womb as safe as she could. Women were fragile. They shouldn't do too much math or read too much. If they were gently bred, they should, you know, like tinkle on the piano a little bit and, you know, paint pretty things, nothing too upsetting. And their job was essentially to be decorative companions to wealthy men. That was their job. Mary Wollstonecraft was like, no way. She said, that's not the life I want. That's not the life I want women to have. And it's not good for men either. So she, as I was reading this, I was thinking, what's that? My students use this expression, you go, Mary Wollstonecraft. I thought, wow, you're really great. So when the French Revolution breaks out and all the English are streaming home in terror, Mary Wollstonecraft jumps on a ship to go over to Paris so she can see the revolution firsthand. She's going to be a foreign war correspondent. She can taste the excitement even before she gets there. When she gets there, it's thrilling. The king is executed. Alas, the violence, but so exciting. Oh, the aristocrats are on the run. The poor people are being elevated. Marriage has been outlawed. Everybody's living with everybody else. It's great. And by the way, the French Revolution makes Haight-Ashbury seem so tame. Can I just tell you? Oh, so Mary Wollstonecraft fell in love with a very sexy American named Gilbert Imlay. Oh, she realized this is what life is supposed to be like. The merger of two equals. Together we will stand against the world. There's no need for marriage. Yes, I'm pregnant, but there's no need for us to get married because I don't believe in it and he doesn't believe in it and we're equal and we'll love each other forever. And she had his baby and he abandoned her. She was paralyzed with depression. She suffered terribly. But then, as part of a much longer story that if you want to know about, you'll have to read the book, she she went to Scandinavia. Yes, when nobody went to Scandinavia in the 18th century, let alone a woman with a toddler who was suffering from paralyzing depression. But she went to Scandinavia, and while she was in Scandinavia, it was summer, and it was beautiful. So her heart was broken, yes. Oh, but the pine trees, they were so great, and the waterfalls, and she roamed around in nature, and she felt better, she noticed, when she was in nature, and she wrote her thoughts down. Today, I roamed around in nature, and at first I was depressed, but then I wasn't. And then I felt better, and then I felt a little worse. And then I saw a waterfall, and I felt better. And then She wrote reams of this stuff. And it was, of course, revolutionary. We now know it as Romanticism. And in fact, some young men read all of these works that she wrote while she was in Scandinavia, because she published it, because she was smart, when she came home from Scandinavia. And a young man named Wordsworth read it. And another young man named Coleridge read it. And they said, wow, we want to write like this. We're going to wander around in nature and have some thoughts and feelings. And it's going to be great. So she... I had never known this. She launched Romanticism. It wasn't Wordsworth and Coleridge, as I had been taught in college, but it was Mary Wollstonecraft. And this book that she wrote, which really changed literary history, was also significant in her personal life because it was read by this kind of rock star political philosopher named William Godwin, who is now known today as the father of anarchy. Though he was really, he was kind of a cerebral stiff guy, but that's okay. You can picture someone who's like really wild and crazy if you want, but he wasn't. But he fell in love with her through the book, and he said, I really want to meet her. So they met and in fact fell in love, and here we go again. They have a swift courtship. She gets instantly pregnant again. But this time she decides, and he decides, even though they don't believe in marriage, they live in a stupid society where they probably should get married just to protect the baby. Mm-hmm. So they get married feeling like they're really, you know, selling out, but they do it. They're living in London now, and their life is pretty great. They're pretty happy, and they're waiting for the birth of the baby. It's so exciting. And finally, at the end of August 1797, Mary Wollstonecraft goes into labor, and she gives birth, and it's a little girl, and they name her Mary, and it's so great. And then 10 days later, she dies of childbed fever. It's like, wait, my whole theory about cool Mary Wollstonecraft influencing her cool daughter, Mary Shelley, has just been blown out the window. No wonder no one ever talks about her being the mother of Mary Shelley if she died 10 days after giving birth to Mary Shelley, right? How much influence could she have had on Mary Shelley? Well, Mary Shelley never really did get to know her mother, but in fact, she was profoundly influenced by Wollstonecraft because, to begin with, her father was grief-stricken, and every day they would walk from their house to the mother's gravestone, to Wollstonecraft's gravestone, and this is actually where little Mary Shelley learned to read, is by tracing the letters of her mother's name on the gravestone. There was a gigantic portrait of Mary Wollstonecraft in their house where she was pregnant with her little baby Mary, and all of Mary Wollstonecraft's friends came over and marveled at little Mary. Oh, you're so like her. Are you going to be a genius just like your mother? Yes. She said, I'm going to be. So as time goes on, Mary Shelley, who was a great reader, became a kind of expert on all things Wollstonecraft. She read every book that her mother wrote over and over again until she had decided that she was going to carry the torch of her mother forward. She was going to be the second Mary Wollstonecraft. And when she was 16, she met a really romantic poet. Oh, his name was Percy. Unfortunately, he was already married, which was inconvenient. But who cared about convention? Neither of them. They meet. She knew exactly where she should take him. They walk briskly to her mother's grave, where she flings herself into his arms. She's 16. He's 20. She says, Percy, I love you. We must be together. They consummate their relationship right there on the grave. And, right, this is why Gregor said it's sort of unbelievable how badly behaved they were. And she says, she's sort of the boss, even though she's 16, she says, Percy, I know what we have to do now that we know we love each other and we've had sex. We have to run away to Paris because that's what my mom did. So they run away to Paris and they launch themselves into an incredible life that no one approved of. Everyone hated them. When they tried to come back to England, no one spoke to them. She was little young Mary Shelley, lived in social exile for most of her life. But carrying forward, this sort of torch of her mother, was both the solace and the inspiration that really kept her going in her life. By the time she was 19, she had really made up her mind that she wanted to be a writer just like her mother. And one summer, she and Percy decided that they would vacation in Geneva with their good friend, Lord Byron, who made both of them seem prim and boring. A volcano somewhere had gone off. It was famously known as the year without a summer because it was snowing and raining and really snowing all over the world. And, you know, you can't keep romantic poets inside all summer. It doesn't work. They get restless. They get bored, especially Byron. So after many, many days of torrential downpours being shut up inside in Geneva, Byron says to his friends, "You know what? Let's have a contest. Let's see who can write the scariest story." So they all put their hands to it. Shelley kind of tries, but then he gets really more interested in the mountains and starts writing one of his long, like, Shelley poems about mountains. Byron is really too interested in Byron to do much more than write about Byron. His little personal assistant who was there, who wanted to be like Byron but was really not, still managed to pen a little story called The Vampire, which started the vampire tradition in English literary history. And Mary was the only one who, in fact, completed the task, started her story that summer, and after many, many revisions, finished it a year and a half later. She started it when she was 19. She was through with it by the time she was 21. It was published. She went on in her life to write 5 more novels and was also an incredible writer of nonfiction. One of my favorite things about her, in fact, is her ability to nest stories inside of stories, which is really important, it turns out, if you're writing things that no one wants to hear. So this is more stuff that no one knew. She was the only female contributor to the first English encyclopedia, which might sound really boring to you. I know that my students' eyes would roll back in their head, the word encyclopedia, but this was an encyclopedia that was filled with sort of long-form narrative, so that each essay about the people in the encyclopedia was about 10,000 words long. And Mary Shelley, who was, in fact, not just the most educated woman that anyone knew, but the most educated writer of her time, because she had taught herself ancient Greek and Latin, she could speak Italian, French, Spanish, and Portuguese, was in charge of writing about the romantic authors of the past. So she did this, and she went to the encyclopedia guy, and she said, "You know, I found in my research that there's some very interesting women who lived during this, you know, during these centuries. Why don't we do an encyclopedia of famous women?" And the encyclopedia guy was like, "What? Are you kidding me? You're the only literary woman I know, and there's no point." So here's what Mary Shelley did. She would be writing, say, a biographical entry of, say, Montaigne. And she'd say, "Michel Montaigne was a great essayist, and he wrote a lot of essays. But his niece, Marie, now she was a great writer. Here's a poem that she wrote. Here's all the things that she did to organize his work. She was a true intellectual." Marie would completely take over the Montaigne entry. And I thought, Mary Shelley, you're amazing. To sort of end the story of my quest, I realized as I read these biographies that Shelley only occurred in the kind of epilogues of Wollstonecraft biographies, and Mary Wollstonecraft only occurred in the introductions to Mary Shelley biographies. And everybody assumed, because Mary Wollstonecraft had died, that she had not influenced her daughter. But in fact, the more I read, the more it was clear to me that Mary Shelley had dedicated herself to trying to live in the tradition of her mother, that many of the literary innovations, most of her scandalous social activity, had been based on the example of her mother. And I realized when I looked for a biography of the mother and daughter, and there wasn't one, I realized that I was going to have to do it. And that's the origin of Romantic Outlaws. And now, especially for Gregor, I'm going to read 17 chapters. All set, Gregor? You might want to sit. Do you guys have any questions? Anything you'd like to know more about?
Did Wallencraft have any opinion about slavery?
Oh, yes.
You said.
Yes. Yeah. They both did. The question was, did Wollstonecraft have any opinions about slavery? Yes, it was bad. Yes. Mary Shelley and Percy Shelley were even more active anti-slavery people. They gave up sugar because they didn't want to, you know, contribute to the slave trade. Shelley wrote essays against it. And in fact, Frankenstein was in part based on some of Mary's readings about the sufferings of slaves on the plantations. So the monster, some of his suffering is based on, yeah, on slave narratives.
How long was she really with Shelley before something happened there, which is sort of a repetition of her mother's thing?
Oh, Percy Shelley drowned, tragically. And she was left to live her life alone for another 30 years. He was dead by the time she was 24 and he was 28. Yes, Dale.
Did she, was she popular in her time?
No. In fact, nobody much read Frankenstein. 500 copies were published. They didn't sell out. The reason why it became popular was because in 18th century England, playwrights could take novels or stories that they liked and put them on the stage without paying the writer a penny. And the play version became famous. And so she did actually become a household name by her 30s and 40s, but in a kind of bad way. So there were protests outside theaters, you know, putting on this immoral play written by a woman. What kind of woman would do this? And so she wrote a preface to a much later version of Frankenstein where people had said, how could a woman have written this? And in her preface, she said, well, you know, one night I was asleep and it came to me in a dream. And what could I do but write this story? So for years, I think she's still taught in high school as, oh, Frankenstein came to Mary Shelley in a dream and she just wrote it down one day. But, you know, we have the notebooks and we see what she did. She worked very hard on it. Well, actually was by her writing, and she lived in debt. She wrote tons and tons of stories for ladies' magazines, none of which she was proud of.
Mm-hmm. Would you say more about your read of Frankenstein that was mentioned in the paper? I understand your read to be different from canonical interpretation that we generally see.
The question was, what's my interpretation of Frankenstein that's unusual? Right. I think because I came to Mary Shelley by seeing her through the lens of Wollstonecraft, I saw her as the daughter of Mary Wollstonecraft. And so that led me to see Frankenstein instead of just being a cautionary tale about the dangers and yet the importance of science and technological advance, which of course Frankenstein is about that. But I saw the book as a story about what happens to a world without mothers, that without mothers and in the absence of maternal figures, we have violence, we have unleashed ambition, we have lack of community and family feeling, we have cruelty, and all of Mary Shelley's books, that's the predominant theme.
Haven't read the new one yet, but I wondered what kind of a different challenge was it, you know, when you compare your process of writing the one book about the Puritan and here these Europeans in a different sense.
Rod just asked, how is it different to write this book from writing my first book about a Puritan poet who rarely misbehaved named Anne Bradstreet? Well, to begin with, these guys, the Romantics, so Romantic Outlaws, there was so much material to read. If they had a thought or a feeling, they wrote it down. And then their Victorian descendants tried to burn what they wrote down. So then there's copies and there's false versions and there's partially burned versions. And there's, you know, there's still hidden letters that are coming to light. Oh, it's, you know, there's a whole story about the archives of these people. One of my favorite parts of the research was Mary Wollstonecraft and William Godwin, who were profoundly unconventional people, broke the rules even when they did get married by keeping separate residences because they didn't want to disrupt their writing lives with their domestic life. But in true sort of 20th and 21st century fashion, Mary Wollstonecraft complained that the burdens of domestic duties fell too much on her shoulders. But we have a record of this because, kind of like email, they would send little notes back and forth to each other all day long. So you can go to the Bodleian and you can read these great little notes. Can you bring me my spectacles when you come over for lunch? We're having mutton for dinner. And by the way, why do I have to deal with the plumber? My time is as important as your time is, William. They're so great to read. You can hear their voices. You feel like, I felt like I was eavesdropping on them. I mean, it's sort of a weird voyeuristic process. So in some ways, I used to joke that Mr. Bradstreet could have been called, you know, if, what if, because there were, you know, there were 50 poems and one spiritual autobiography and then a bunch of other diaries by other Puritans that I had to comb through. And a lot of it was me painfully trying to reconstruct what life was like here in 1630. With these guys, there was so much material that it was so much fun. I mean, it really was a delight. It was like a garden of information and scandal. I mean, really, it was really fun. And also upsetting. They suffered. They also suffered. I cried during, you know, there's some hard chapters.
What happened to the first child?
Oh. For example, do you want to know? Should I tell you?
Yeah.
No. Yeah, maybe you should wait.
Not good, huh?
It wasn't good.
Fanny. I'm going to tell you. I loved Fanny. Fanny was the first child that Mary had with this sexy American who abandoned her. And Mary loved her. And she wrote this really charming little children's book for Fanny to learn how to read with. So you get a real sense of what their life was like. Like Fanny, now that you're a big girl, you can use a bigger knife when we make the apple pie. And remember that this is how we feed the dog, because just like you don't want to be hungry, the dog doesn't want to be hungry either. I mean, it's so sweet and heartbreaking. She loved her mother, and her mother loved her. It was the two of them against the world. And I can only imagine for that 3.5-year-old what it was like to lose her mother. So she never felt that she had a place that she truly belonged. She was adopted by William Godwin, but by the age of 19 or 20, had reached the end of her very sad rope and killed herself. Oh. Really sad story. Mm-hmm. And Godwin, the father or the husband, made no bones about preferring little Mary. You know, Mary was prettier, smarter. Everyone knew it. Horrible.
If you could find out more about one of the Marys through a conversation, which one would you pick?
Right at this moment, I'd like to ask Mary, how did she really love Percy through it all? Like, he was such a jerk through the middle years that I just think that, I mean, I wonder, did she give him permission to just go sleep with other people and leave her alone? Or, you know, at the end, after he died, she was heartbroken and she missed him. But I sometimes wonder if it was sort of best friend status or what. So I would love to add, I don't think she'd tell me the truth, though.
Did she have an affair with Lord Byron?
No, she did not. Everyone said they called, the English called this band of friends the League of Incest. And everyone said that everyone was having affairs with everyone else. And they would, the English in Switzerland would watch them with their binoculars and try to see what they were up to. But Mary, one of the things I love about Mary, she was sort of a true blue intellectual. She had no interest, actually, in having an affair with Byron, who is known as being the sexiest man alive. They were intellectual friends. They traded manuscripts back and forth. He respected her opinion as a writer. She, of course, respected his opinion as a writer. And so he would ask her opinion on early drafts of some of his poems. They remained good writing friends until his premature death. Also, he really liked men better anyways. Yeah. Mary Shelley buried her political writings inside other writings. So she did write travel narratives, and embedded in the travel narratives, you can find her politics, like Austria, get out of Italy. You know, every state needs to have its own independence. Anti-slavery, freedom, the rights of women, all of her novels are dedicated to the idea that women should be independent, that women should have education. There are no heroes in any of Mary Shelley's novels, and they're all anti-war, profoundly anti-war. So you can figure out her politics.
But she didn't write.
No, no. It's really, you can tell she's in a different era, a much more dangerous era, really, because Wollstonecraft is alive during this sort of hopeful, optimistic Enlightenment period before the Revolution. And after the French Revolution, there's a real crackdown in England where the British are really afraid that, you know, the Revolution is going to spread and come to England. And so there's a conservative reaction.
Charlotte, were the consequences of the scandals a badge of honor, or were they just the product of irresponsible behavior and not and a lack of foresight? How did this proceed?
What a great question. The question were the scandals worn as a badge of honor, or what was the result of the scandals? For the women, it was way worse than for the men. I think the men wore the scandal as badges of honor. Then they went and died, and the women were left, you know, having to deal. Mary Wollstonecraft was called a whore, a hyena in petticoats. Mary Shelley was just called a whore. We almost lost Mary Wollstonecraft to history because of what happened to her reputation. After she died, William Godwin refused to go to her funeral or anything conventional like that. He locked himself into his study with a pen 3 days after she had died and started writing her biography. And he decided he'd only known her for 14 months, but he decided he knew her best. And he also thought, as a true philosopher, that he would tell the whole truth. So every relationship she'd ever had with a man, he told. He told the story about the birth of illegitimate Fanny and exposed her and her scandals in a public way. And ever since, her reputation sunk. For the next 120 years, if you were a radical, you actually didn't want to be associated with Mary Wollstonecraft. If you look in 19th century dictionaries under the word whore, it will say prostitute, see Mary Wollstonecraft. She really was. She was almost lost to history. And there's like this invisible train of women, writers, who kept her alive. Elizabeth Barrett Browning and George Eliot. And then finally, Virginia Woolf resuscitated her in the 1920s. But that's why it's a brilliant question, is because, of course, the attacks on her sexuality almost did her in. Shelley is a different story, which I, you know, you're being so nice and listening, but I don't want to take your time too much. Yeah. It was an opposite set of attacks that almost did Mary Shelley's reputation in. Mary Shelley died right at the beginning of the Victorian era, and her obituaries, nobody mentioned her writing. They all said what a devoted and wonderful wife she had been to Percy. The scandal had kind of been forgotten. Her daughter-in-law was psyched and tried to rewrite history and killed off Shelley's wife before Mary and Percy had met, so there would be no scandal, and tried to whitewash the whole thing. And so Mary Shelley comes down to us until the 1960s, 70s as a very prim Victorian who was really in love with Percy and helped him sometimes with his work. And he helped her a lot. In fact, he probably wrote Frankenstein. So they had sort of the opposite, you know, the opposite two worst case scenarios for female writers is what happened to them.
What was the American opinion of Mary Wollstonecraft in her lifetime? Was there an intellectual class awareness of writing?
Yes, that's a great question. Yes. John Adams was one of her big fans, and Abigail Adams was one of her big fans. And what's really interesting about Mary Wollstonecraft is that she was sort of born angry and born rebellious and had the strength somehow to fight off her tyrannical father and horrible older brother. But what I think really changed her life was her sort of searching and yearning for education. And when she was 16, she had a turning point that sounds really boring if you are my college student, but it was really gripping for her. She read John Locke. Now try to look excited. I know. But again, as usual, my students, it's very good for me to have students. It keeps me humble. They are would be so bored by now. She read John Locke when she was 16, and he was so radical in the 18th century that he was illegal. I mean, you were not allowed to read him at Oxford. And the other people who were reading him in 1775 were Thomas Jefferson, Edward Gibbon. I mean, the list of Enlightenment, you know, intellectuals goes on and on and on. But John Locke changed Mary Wollstonecraft's life because of his idea that we are all born with a blank slate. We are all born with a blank slate, men and women alike. And when she read that, she felt empowered. And she looked to the Americans and the American Revolution as an inspiration. And many of her sort of guides in England also looked to the American Revolution. So there was great solidarity. It's a brilliant question. So the American Revolution played a huge role in her life. And American intellectuals who were radical all loved her and read her book, The French Revolution, when her report of the French Revolution when she went over many times. And if you go to the Boston Public Library, where you can see John Adams's library, you can take out his copy of Wollstonecraft's French Revolution and see all of his marginalia. He fights with her. He says, "Thank you, Mistress Wollstonecraft." The question is, how morbid was her fascination with, you know, her dead mother, et cetera? I would say that I wouldn't actually use the word morbid for Mary Shelley. I would use the word depressed. That's not a word that they used then, but I would say she struggled her whole life long with depression that was crippling often, as her mother had. And I think that the result of sort of the endless yearning for this mother she never had ended up being a really sort of lonely sort of existence. And I think the smart part of her was able to sort of craft this into literary, you know, imaginings, so that spirits, you know, the dead, bringing the dead back to life, etc., were going to be obsessions of hers, of course. But, you know, she also felt like a murderer. She felt guilty also because she'd killed her mother. So she never felt kind of an innocent yearning for her mother. She always felt implicated as well, which is one reason why I think Frankenstein is still such an interesting and complicated book, because you can feel her taking on both points of view, the creator and the created.
What about Shelley's wife? Didn't she commit suicide?
Yes, you're telling. No one's going to read the book. Yes. Yes, Percy Shelley's abandoned wife also flung herself into a river. Yes. There was a lot of that.
Which libertine or bad man are you going to write about next?
Great question. Should we call it a night? Oh, no, there's one. Yeah. Yeah.
You mentioned the influence of John Locke and the blank slate. I'm wondering if Locke also exerted an impact in terms of his belief in the necessity for the social contract.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Could you speak more to that? Because that
Yes. The question was, I gave a sort of quick chat about John Locke and the idea of the blank slate. And the second part to the question is, how did his idea of the social contract or compact, how did that influence both Marys? So for both of them, this idea that if you had government, and in the 18th century, the word government meant not just the politically, you know, instated government, but also meant inside a household or self-government, that if you had this idea that if you had a government that was taking away your rights, that you then had the right to protest or remove yourself from that set of shackles was life-changing. It was life-changing for everyone in the 18th century. That's why no one could read him at Oxford. It was a shocking idea to say, you know what? You have the right to say that this government is taking away your naturally born, your free-born rights. What an idea. I mean, it changed the world. I mean, I could, of course, talk about that for another hour, but that's the short version, yeah.
Another book,
right. John Locke, All That You Thought You Knew.
I was just curious, why did she write The Rights of Men? Was that the first one that she wrote? Why was she so passionate about writing about that? And what was that about?
Well, you know, she came from this tradition of reading John Locke. So that's very much where she started.
Men was humankind.
Men was humankind, but she found herself, when writing about humankind, being drawn to the particular case of women. Which is interesting. Well, there's actually a slightly longer answer to that question, which is that she was responding to Edmund Burke, who had once been her hero. He had promoted the American Revolution, and all of the radicals in England had loved him. Go, Burke. But when the French Revolution broke out, Burke had said, bad revolution. He said, you're going to ruin your country. And it turned out that Burke was far more conservative than his fans had realized. So he wrote a tract that was essentially attacking the revolutionaries in France. And Mary Wollstonecraft was the first to respond with her tract, A Vindication of the Rights of Men, saying that the revolution was justified. And so she was sort of playing in the big league. And to fight with Burke would be like to fight with any of our, you know, sort of most distinguished pundits today. She, of course, no one knew she was a woman when she first did this.
And how would something like that have been distributed?
She had a beloved publisher who published every single thing that she wrote.
Under her name?
Not at first. The first edition of Vindication of the Rights of Men was just anonymous. It sold so well that when they put out the second edition, they put her name on it, and immediately it was criticized as being irrational and poorly organized. All right, so shall we call it a night? All right. Thank you so much.